Your Honor, we the jury find the defendant Sweet Tango Apples guilty on all counts of being the crispiest, sweetest, zestiest, most delicious tasting apple you can buy.
Order! Order in this courtroom! Bailiff, come back here. Where are you going?
I'm going with them. I want some Sweet Tango Apples too.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Welcome to the True Crime Never Sleeps podcast. We dive into stories of true crime, from unsolved cold cases to historic kidnapping to gangsters and beyond. We are your source for true crime. We thank you for listening.
When pediatric nurse Kimberly Cates and her husband David relocated to the picturesque New England town of Mount Vernon, New Hampshire in 2003, the safety-conscious couple had wasted no time having an alarm system installed. With a young daughter to think about, they weren't taking any chances. After a year or so of peaceful living without fear of crime entering their lives, they relaxed and allowed themselves to believe that nothing had ever happened in the little slice of heaven they now call home. In the early morning hours of October 4th, 2009, while David was away on business, the threat of violence the Cates family thought they had left behind in the big city found its way into their sanctuary with devastating results. Around 3 a.m., Kimberly had been awakened by a dim light shining in her face. Thinking that her daughter needed her, she had sat up in bed and asked, "Jamie, is that you?" Her query was met with a series of savage blows from a machete, 36 in all. She was also stabbed numerous times in the neck and torso by a second assailant. Alerted by her mother's screams, 11-year-old Jamie, who had been sound asleep in the same bed, bolted upright and attempted to run. Progress was halted by a knife-wielding intruder who proceeded to stab her 18 times in the chest, arms, legs, and back. At one point, she had fallen into her attacker's arms, prompting him to throw her across the room into a glass door. Assuming that both of their victims were dead, the killer spent the next few minutes looking for valuables. After pilfering several items of jewelry, they had fled into the night. When she was certain that the coast was clear, Jamie, who had lain perfectly still as the home invaders stepped over her lifeless form, crawled into the kitchen and dialed 911. After telling the dispatcher in a voice barely above a whisper that someone killed her mother, she collapsed on the floor. At around 4 o'clock that morning, first responders arrived on the scene. The officer who found Jamie recalled that she had been covered in blood, part of her left foot was missing, and she had suffered numerous injuries, including a fractured jaw and a deep laceration across her throat. Despite her grim condition, she was conscious and remarkably lucid. In the bedroom, paramedics discovered Kimberly's brutalized body. Upon confirming that she had not survived the excessively violent attack, a call was placed to the county coroner. An autopsy would show that the 36 blows Kimberly sustained had all but destroyed much of her body. Among other things, her skull had been split nearly in half. It was clear that whoever was behind the killing had acted without restraint, hacking away at the helpless woman in her own bed. The official determination held that though the injuries had done irreparable damage, none had been lethal. Rather, Kimberly had bled to death. It was surmised that she had likely been awake and aware of what was happening to her throughout much of the attack. As investigators were combing over the crime scene, Crosstown's 17-year-old Stephen Spader and his toady 19-year-old Christopher Gribble showed up at the home of their mutual friend, Autumn Savoy, shortly before sunrise. After excitedly telling them that they had just killed two people, they asked for his help in getting rid of evidence. Not the least bit surprised by the admission, since he had been asked in advance to participate, but had wisely declined, Savoy agreed to lend a hand. At 5:30 a.m., the trio gathered up the bloody clothing that had been worn during the killings, along with the stolen goods they decided weren't worth selling, and threw them into the Nashua River. Believing they were free and clear, Spader and Gribble had then retreated to their respective houses to catch a few hours of sleep. Upon waking, Gribble had headed to a pawn shop to unload Kimberly's gold jewelry. The entire lot had yielded a paltry $130. Driving home the point that killing had been the perpetrator's ultimate motive rather than financial gain. Later in the afternoon, the pair had paid a visit to the home of another friend, Kyle Fint. As they bragged loudly about the double homicide they had pulled off without a hitch, they were unaware that their buddy's mother could hear every word. Knowing what she had to do, she promptly called the police. As it turned out, Spader and Gribble had been making the rounds, boasting to their friends and acquaintances of the killings throughout the morning. Instead of being impressed, several of the stunned listeners had reported the omissions to authorities. Before the day was through, both Spader and Gribble were in custody. In addition to the two main players, their accomplices William Marks, 18, and Quinn Glover, 17, were also picked up and brought in for questioning. After being read his rights, Gribble was asked about his involvement in the murders in an interview that he was informed was being recorded. Seemingly unbothered by his current situation, the suspect had assured detectives that his knowledge of the crime was limited to what he had seen on the 6 o'clock news. Gribble, who was cool as a cucumber throughout the hours-long interrogation, described himself as a gentleman whose chivalrousness would never allow him to harm a female. He went on to claim that he was appalled at the notion that anyone could inflict such violence upon anyone, especially an 11-year-old child. When he was informed that Jamie had survived and would be able to identify her assailant, he acted as if he were thrilled with the news. Even after learning that he was being implicated by his cohorts, Gribble refused to budge. Determined to walk away scot-free, he wasn't about to put a noose around his neck. There was any way around it. After repeatedly proclaiming his innocence, Gribble eventually shut down the interview. Following the letter of the law, detectives had turned off the tape recorder and left the room. The suspect, who had made no attempt to leave, remained in the interrogation room alone with his thoughts. A little while later, Gribble summoned one of the detectives with whom he had established a rapport back into the room. Seemingly out of curiosity, he had asked if the Cates killing would warrant the death penalty. The detective couldn't say for certain, but he indicated that the state of New Hampshire had stringent requirements for such an extreme sentence, and he didn't believe that this case would fall under that umbrella. Gribble had then inquired about the possible prison terms that would be handed down if the killers were found guilty. After pondering his options, he told the detectives to turn the tape recorder back on. He was ready to reveal what he knew. Before proceeding, the investigators had made a point of having Gribble repeat his request to speak on record. He was also informed that his right to remain silent still applied. After affirming that he was acting of his own free will, he gave a detailed account of the events that had taken place less than 24 hours earlier. According to Gribble, his best friend Stephen had masterminded the murders. In the days leading up to the actual crime, Spader and William had scouted locations, searching for a secluded property with no neighbors close enough to hear the screams. They had found exactly what they were looking for at 4 Truro Road, the Cates residence. Gribble insisted that none of them knew who lived in the house and didn't care. Their plan was to kill everyone and to steal anything they thought they could sell for profit. Upon arriving at the house under cover of darkness, the group, which consisted of Gribble, Spader, Marks, and Glover,
88% of the workweek is spent communicating, so it's important your team does it well. Enter Grammarly. Grammarly's AI helps teams communicate clearly the first time. It shows you how to make words resonate with your audience, helps with brainstorming, and lets you instantly create and revise drafts in just one click. Join over 70,000 teams and 30 million people who use Grammarly to move work forward. Go to grammarly.com/enterprise to learn more. Grammarly. Enterprise ready AI.
This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com. This October, Tanger invites you to shop pink and save lives. Your donation of $10 or more to the Breast Cancer Research Foundation helps fuel innovative research that brings us closer to a cure. It also unlocks exclusive savings from brands like Coach, Crocs, Columbia Factory Store, and more to shop all month long. Join us as we mark 30 years of advancing research and empowering hope. Donate and access your exclusive savings today at Tanger.com.
Found the place locked up tight. Since Marks was small of stature and reed thin, they decided that he would sneak in through a narrow basement window and let the others in by way of an upstairs door. Although he was successful in entering the dwelling, once inside, Marks discovered that he couldn't get out of the basement. Moving to Plan B, the others removed a window air conditioner and climbed in through the gaping space it had occupied. They had then unlocked the basement door, allowing Marks to join them. At that point, they had been on the property for over half an hour. After disabling the lights via the breaker box, the quartet of home invaders had gone from room to room, using the lights from their cell phone as their guide. It was in the master bedroom that they found what they were looking for. Spader and Gribble unleashed a frenzied attack on the defenseless mother and daughter. Marks watched from the doorway, taking in the carnage. Clover, unable to stomach the grisly scene, had retreated to the living room until it was over. Throughout his confession, Gribble had maintained an emotionless monotone, his voice betraying not a shred of regret or remorse. He had spoken of the gurgling sounds coming from Kimberly that had prompted him to stab her in the throat in the same manner as one would describe writing a grocery list. He also lamented the fact that he hadn't made sure that Jamie was dead. He asserted that this was because of his innate cruelty, but rather because he felt that it would have spared her the pain of going through life without a mother. As Gribble was telling his version of events, Stephen Spader was across the hall doing the same. While he too had started out protesting his innocence after learning that his buddies were telling a different story, he dropped the "who, me?" routine pretty quickly. Not one bit ashamed of his actions, he had told his story with a sense of accomplishment that only those who kill with ease are capable of understanding. When describing the events of the previous night, Spader recounted how the little girl had screamed and struggled with Gribble while he hacked up the mom. As it turned out, Spader had been a ticking time bomb since the moment he sprung from the womb of his drug-addled mother. Although he was adopted when he was 5 days old by a loving family who had given him the world and more, he was a bad seed. No amount of tough love or coddling was going to change who he was at his core. His adoptive mother recalled that he had been a model child until he reached middle school when seemingly overnight he turned into a monster she no longer recognized as her son. Defiant, belligerent, and at times violent, her dream child turned into her worst nightmare. Hoping to save him from himself, his parents pulled him out of public school and enrolled him in a private institution. Determined to choose his own path, Spader, who was now heavily involved in the local drug scene, dropped out. Not quite ready to give up on their son, his parents sent him to a therapist. This gesture, while well-intentioned, did nothing to alter his downward spiral. Even as he kept his family at arm's length, Spader was forming his own support system via a group of social outcasts who were in desperate need of a leader. Against all odds, they found what they were looking for in the former school bully who bragged openly of his desire to kill total strangers for the thrill of watching them die. The band of miscreants, whom Spader dubbed the Disciples of Destruction, consisted of Gribble, Marks, and Glover, founder as supreme leader. Followers that they were, the trio missed.
Your Honor, I'd like to present to the ladies and gentlemen of the jury with Exhibit B, a bag of Sweet Tango apples.
Boy, these apples are delicious.
And zesty? And sweet.
Best I ever tasted.
Your Honor, I object. Overruled. Court dismissed. We need to recess to the grocery store for some Sweet Tango apples.
You love a great mystery, but not in the produce aisle. Be sure to reach for Sweet Tango, the most delicious tasting apple money can buy. Investigate where you can get yours at sweettango.com.
Fitz vowed to do so. Do as they were instructed or be forever ostracized from the Brotherhood. As part of their initiation into the group, the teenagers had to agree to participate in a home invasion. Not only would they be expected to rob and pillage, but also to kill all the occupants, whether they be men, women, or children. Shockingly, none of them had batted an eye at the prospect of taking innocent lives on Spader's orders. Given their mutual admiration of mass murderers and serial killers, whom they viewed as folk heroes to be emulated, perhaps their willingness to take the lives of others wasn't so surprising after all. While Gribble had been hesitant to admit guilt, or at least initially, Spader showed or shared no such qualms. Seeing the writing on the wall, he readily confessed to his role in the murder of Kimberly Cates, the attempted murder of her daughter, Jamie. Rather than showing remorse, he had been upset with himself for making the mistake of choosing accomplices whose incompetence in leaving behind a living witness had led to their capture. While the suspects were being interviewed, a search was being performed on Gribble's car. Inside the vehicle, deputies found an axe, a box of trash bags, a shovel, gloves, rope, camouflage clothing, and a pawn shop receipt dated for earlier that morning. At the conclusion of the interrogation, Spader was remanded to custody and charged with first-degree murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit burglary, and witness tampering. His fellow inmates in the county jail would later tell authorities that Spader had boasted about the attack that decimated the Cates family. Whether his captive audience wanted to hear it or not, he would relive the night of the murder over and over again, making sure to emphasize the number of blows he had administered with the machete, along with his victim's agonized responses. At trial, Marks, Glover, and Savoy testified against Spader in exchange for lighter sentences. On the stand, Glover told the jury that the defendant would often share his fantasies about breaking into a home and slaughtering the occupants. Not only had he wanted to kill them in the most gruesome of fashions, but had allegedly wanted to cook and feast upon their remains, if time allowed. This allegation reformed the prosecution's characterization of Spader as a psychopath. Glover, who had fled to the living room and covered his ears to muffle the victim's screams, had been the only one to recoil from the violence that was perpetrated upon the helpless mother and child. Although he was a fan of horror movies and had an interest in serial killers, the reality was far worse than he had mentioned. With that said, he had gone along, even after Spader had informed his disciples on the way to the Cates residence, that they were about to be a part of the evilest thing this town has ever seen. In November 2010, Spader was found guilty on all counts and sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. The trial judge, not holding back, told him outright that he belonged in a cage. 2 years later, following changes in the law that negated life without parole for those who committed their offenses as minors, Spader became eligible for a reduced sentence. When the subject was broached, Spalner balked. Happy where he was, he refused to cooperate with the appeal process, informing his attorneys that he was the most sick and twisted person you'll ever meet. He washed his hands of the proceedings. Moving ahead without him, his legal team applied for the reduction. In the end, Spader received a sentence of life plus 76 years. In 2013, he ordered his attorneys to drop all appeals. Today, he's imprisoned in New Jersey, where he will remain for the duration of his natural life. Glover pleaded guilty to burglary, robbery, and conspiracy to commit burglary, and was sentenced to 20 to 40 years behind bars. His earliest possible release date will be in 2029. Marks, who observed the vicious attack on Kimberly and Jamie from the doorway, pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit both murder and burglary. For his role in the mayhem, he was sentenced to 30 to 60 years in prison. Marks' father, who had stood by his troubled son through thick and thin, expressed regret for the home invasion and subsequent murder. Even so, he couldn't help but wonder what would have happened if William had faced harsher penalties for his previous run-ins with the law. A malcontent who had spurned his parents' attempts to put him on the right path through therapy, the 18-year-old had a dark side that no amount of intervention seemed able to keep at bay. In a poem penned by Marx, he had ominously shared his twisted desires by stating, quote, "I always keep an axe by my side, looking for my next homicide." Hopefully he will receive the help he needs during the many years he will spend in the custody of the state. Autumn Savoy, who had aided in the cover-up, was ordered to serve 5 to 12 years for hindering apprehension and conspiracy. He was paroled in 2012, and as far as anyone knows, presumably having learned his lesson, he has stayed out of trouble. Christopher Gribble, though not the ringleader, is an even more terrifying specimen than Spader, if such a thing is possible. When he faced a judge in 2011, he exuded both arrogance and evil from every pore. A devout Mormon who had planned to become a missionary before going another way entirely, he admitted that he had been consumed with thoughts of murder since childhood. The target of his murderous fantasies in those early years was the person he was closest to in the world, his mother. Gribble's built-up hostility towards his mother stemmed from her methods of discipline, which he found to be extreme. According to him, he endured spankings that he believed went too far. As a teenager, he had considered it a form of corporal punishment when his mom would insist on popping the acne on his back. He also complained about such mundane things as having been forced to vacuum the house at a young age. While some might see performing household chores as character building, he viewed it as yet another degrading punishment dished out by the woman he had grown up to despise. In a voice completely devoid of emotion, Gribble related how he wanted to cut pieces off of her and listen to her scream. He also wondered what it would be like to throw her into a vat of boiling water or smother her in sugar and tie her down to a hill of fire ants. Much like the other parents of Spader's motley crew, Gribble's family had taken him to see a psychiatrist to no avail. The so-called expert in her field had brushed it off when her patient confided that he felt he had the potential to become a serial rapist. He also told her of his deep-seated hatred of his parents, especially his mother. He let the therapist know, in no uncertain terms, that he would like to see them dead. Although their son's psychiatrist had shared this information with the Gribbles, she assured them that he was merely blowing off steam. He likened his outburst to an angry child threatening to kill someone in a fit of temper. In her opinion, he wasn't a danger to himself or others. And with that, Christopher Gribble was given the green light to act on his disturbing thoughts. The victims, however, wouldn't be his long-suffering parents, but rather an innocent young mother and her only child. A loner who had trouble making friends, Gribble had first met Spader in Boy Scouts. After losing touch, the pair reconnected in 2009, and a symbiotic relationship was forged. Ribble, a follower in need of guidance, and Spader, a natural leader who wanted control over others, were a perfect storm of sinister energy waiting to be unleashed upon the world. Ribble made no secret of the fact that he knew before entering the Kate's home that everyone inside was going to die. When the time came for him to spring into action, he had stabbed both Jamie and her mother in calculated strokes, unlike his cohort, who had swung the machete with such wild abandon that his right-hand man had feared becoming yet another casualty before all was said and done. As pompous a defendant as the court had ever seen, Gribble presented himself as a force to be reckoned with. When the very possibility of spending decades in prison were posed to him, he had smirked and replied, quote, "They," meaning the other inmates, "have no idea who they're messing with." As it happened, Gribble would soon have to defend his words with actions. At trial's end, he was found guilty of first-degree murder, attempted murder, conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit burglary, and witness tampering. For his crimes, he was sentenced to life without parole. The judge informed him that, had it been within her power, she would have sentenced him to infinity. Jamie and her father stayed in the home on Trail Road after the attack that left her family in shambles. For their protection, they purchased a guard dog and utilized an alarm system. Though their lives would never be the same, they persevered. In the hopes of ensuring that Kimberly lived on in the community, an annual golf tournament was established in her name. Proceedings of the charity event, which take place every year on the anniversary of her murder, go towards a scholarship fund set up for local students with their sights set on higher education. Jamie, who is now in her 20s, graduated from college and pursued a career in the healthcare field. A happy, grounded young woman, she has long since moved past the events of that dreadful night, when a chapter of her life was closed and another one opened. While she will carry both the physical and emotional scars inflicted by the perpetrators for the rest of her life, she refuses to let them define her. She's a survivor, pure and simple. Kimberly Cates was by all accounts, a ray of sunshine that was extinguished much too soon. Outgoing, warm, loving, energetic, and kind, her death was felt throughout the community. Born caregiver without an enemy in the world, she was a victim chosen at random by four malcontents with no regards for lives of others. Chillingly, Gribble had stated in the courtroom that, should he ever be released, he couldn't guarantee that he would never kill again. So let's hope, for society's sake, that we never have to find out. So let me know your thoughts on this case in the comments section below. And as always, give it a thumbs up if you like your video. Hit that subscribe button down below. And if you want to support the channel, buy us coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. What does that do? Well, your support helps the channel grow, upgrade our equipment, bring a new host, be able to pay them, and hopefully take this show on the road. Because we'd love to be able to live record episodes from infamous crime scenes across the country and perhaps across the world. We could do a live episode from Zodiac Killer's crime scenes and more, and your support can help make that happen. As always, thank you so much for watching, listening, and we'll see you next time.
Stop by O'Reilly Auto Parts for the power, performance, and reliability of a new SuperStart battery. Visit O'ReillyAuto.com.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
You have been listening to the True Crime Never Sleeps podcast. Thank you for listening. You can follow us on Facebook at True Crime Never Sleeps podcast and on Twitter at True Crime NS. And follow us on Instagram at True Crime Never Sleeps. Thanks for watching. If you want to support the show, buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNN or become a patron at patreon.com/True Crime Never Sleeps.